Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and today I'm joined by Jonathan Herbst, co-editor with Simon Lovegrove of Brexit and Financial Regulation, published in March by Oxford University Press. Jonathan is the global head of financial services regulation at Norton Rose Fulbright, a global law firm he joined as a partner in 2002. Before that, he was head of European law at the Financial Services Authority. He's a leading practitioner in the field of British and EU financial services law and regulation and specializes in advice around the structuring of banks and markets, custody and clearing, and the regulatory aspects of acquisitions and disposals. Since the referendum 4 years ago that decided the UK should leave the European Union, Jonathan has become a leading commentator on Brexit. He co-authored a report for the Financial Services Forum on regulatory equivalence, a concept we will be discussing in some detail today, and gave evidence to the inquiry led by the House of Lords EU Financial Affairs Subcommittee into the impact of Brexit on financial services. Anyone who thinks this sounds a little esoteric should bear in mind that financial services account for 7% of British economy's total output and more than a million jobs. In just 4 months' time, the UK will leave the transitional stage of EU withdrawal, so changing overnight the regulatory environment for the whole sector, everything from banks to insurers to pension funds. For this new book, Jonathan and his co-editor have pulled together 26 lawyers from 12 law firms and barristers' chambers to write 15 chapters, each covering a critical aspect of the Brexit process or market segment sure to be affected by it. For anyone in the field, lawyers, officials, consultants, or journalists, it is going to be an essential reference work. Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
I know that there's been an update of European banking and financial law by Hentgens and Gioia Carbonelli this year, and inevitably this includes a fair amount of Brexit, but to my knowledge, yours is the only book exclusively on this very important subject. First, is that correct?
I think that's right.
And second, could you take us through how this book came to life? Was it your idea? Did it come from the publisher? Did it start from a conference or a workshop? Or can you?
It's actually a very good question. I think it was actually OUP that got in contact. And in a way, not surprising, because it's such a sort of hot topic. And as you said, given the significance of financial services to the British economy. So I think it was OUP, and then we got into dialogue with them.
Right. And you led with it, or you and Simon Lovegrove led it?
Well, I mean, Simon, I should explain, is our global head of know-how in relation to financial services. So we sort of worked on it together, I'm the global head, and so I led it from the sort of practitioner side, and Simon has been working with me throughout.
And how did you choose who you wanted to take part?
So it's really difficult. I mean, there's some great practitioners out there. We tried to get a really good sort of cross-section of the practitioners in the market, and not everyone said yes, but most people did. So that's what it was. And apologies to anyone who wasn't included. It wasn't deliberate.
Yes, it's like an Oscar speech. I mean, the timing of publication must have been pretty fraught. I mean, you published in March and the Treasury, not wanting to give you a hand, they waited till June to publish their, set out in writing their regulatory intentions. If you'd published in July, for example, if you published now, would much have been altered, do you think?
Yeah. So let me answer your question a slightly different way. The truthful answer is it was really difficult to decide the publication date. We actually originally targeted, believe it or not, a whole year earlier. Of course, not predicting that we would have the endless to-ing and fro-ing. It's difficult to look back at a year and a half. The endless to-ing and fro-ing on the withdrawal agreement in Parliament. And so to write a book like this, the key difficulty then was, you know, what are your assumptions? And given the lead time for the book, very, very difficult. So I think the honest answer is any point in time that you publish, it's going to change. And so in the end, we just had to take a view and pick a date and pick some assumptions. That's what we did.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as you say, things have changed and continue to do so. I mean, you and Simon Lovegrove, in the first two chapters of the book, you give us a potted history of the last 4 years of the positioning of the sector and the negotiations between, actually the negotiations between the UK and the EU and the negotiations within the UK government. Could you basically take us through, could you give us a summary of a potted history of those 4 years and where we are now in the negotiations as we approach January?
Sure. So in some ways, it's actually quite difficult to remember where we started so far. So I think the realities are, and I think it's important to remember, you know, the May government had a very different approach to the current government. They wanted their original negotiated agreement, which eventually they actually managed to complete the negotiations with the EU. And there were really two bits of that. There was the formal, you might call it the transitional withdrawal agreement, which is fairly recognisable in what we've now got, which was effectively, basically a standstill, essentially, or for a period after the UK formally leaving the EU, it would be bound by all the rules for financial services purposes, just for these purposes, but for others as well, and also benefit from the rights. And that was sort of part one of the negotiations. I mean, it went on for hundreds of pages, but in a nutshell, that's what it was. Now, of course, as we know, that agreement in itself took a year and a half to negotiate and is extremely detailed if anybody wishes to read it. However, there was also a second really key bit of what they negotiated, which was the political declaration, which, although it wasn't formally legally binding, was, you know, looked at in minute detail at the time. And there were three or four paragraphs on financial services. And that was a really key aspect. So that's the history of it. As anyone who, you know, followed the parliamentary process in the UK knows, the to-ings and fro-ings over a 12-month period that led up to the failure to get that agreement passed in its original form, you know, you could write a history book on, but probably not for today. But that is essentially where we started, and of course where we ended after the new government was elected. Well, you know, Boris Johnson came in earlier, but once they had a majority after the election, obviously a form of the withdrawal agreement with some tweaks was passed, and effectively that's where we're at now. We're now in this year transitional period.
Yeah. I mean, his brother, Joe Johnson, the Prime Minister's brother, said last year that, quote, one of the UK's only globally competitive sectors is being thrown under a bus by the Brexit process. And he added, how come we've heard so little from a sector that stands to lose so much? Do you think, again, doing some history here, do you think the sector mismanaged its lobbying efforts at the beginning of the process, from essentially from the summer of 2016? Why did it never make, or apparently never made, the case for continued passporting inside the European Economic Area, even before Theresa May's landmark speech at Lancaster House in January 2017?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. My personal view is that's a bit unfair to the city institutions and lobbying groups. I mean, I think there are obviously, as always in these things, we're slightly differing views, but the vast predominant view in the city, and as lobbied by the various trade bodies and the corporation and others at City UK, was that they did want to have a form of whether you call it passporting, I think that was always a bit unrealistic, but let's call it equivalence, by which I mean both under those directives and regulations where there is an equivalence assessment already, and also some additional points, for example, on banking. I think the city's view was that it did want that. I think maybe your question is a slightly different one, which is, why was that voice not heard?
Yeah.
And why was that not the priority politically in the negotiations? And that's almost a different issue around the aftermath of the financial crisis and the fact that perhaps the city and the banking sector does not have the voice it once had. And also that the government was concerned with, you know, let's call it the, in quotes, real economy. And so you had that sort of issue, and whether almost the question could be a different one, which was the city realistic in wanting that comprehensive equivalence deal? But I don't think it would be a fair criticism to say it didn't try and lobby for it. It did. It just didn't get it.
Well, it lobbied for mutual recognition, but I, unless I just don't remember it well, I don't remember the city ever getting behind, for example, when there was a push for a Norway Plus model by some, by a fair number of MPs, actually. I didn't see the city getting behind that, even though that would have ensured pure passporting and wouldn't have required anything else. Is it something I missed, or did it just...
No, I think that's fair. But I think there's a very good reason for that. And I think, to be fair to the city, and this has been one of the dilemmas throughout the last 4 years, in a clearly... the city institutions did not want to be seen to be big P political, or even maybe small P political. And therefore, I think they were, you know, treading a tightrope between, on the one hand, quite reasonably making the points that are relevant to the sector. So if you think about wanting a smooth, let's call it, single market's not perhaps the right word, but a smooth operation of provision of services cross-border, you could achieve that through the Norway Plus model. DEA, you could achieve that through comprehensive mutual recognition, and let's call it equivalence plus, beyond the what is in the European directives and regulations, the key. Either of those could achieve that, broadly speaking. And I think the city, understandably, was very reluctant to be drawn into an explicit political position, because I think it's important now, and it's difficult, given we've got a strong majority government, to remember the frenetic period after 2016, where whatever you said was interpreted as in a deeply political way, and there was this sort of huge division in the country. And I think that's the context of why the city went the route that it did.
I mean, could you outline for us, because I mean, these are going to be key concepts in our discussion, the idea of mutual recognition and the idea of equivalence. I mean, you have a chapter in the book by Aaron Srivastava and Nina Moffat from Paul Hastings on equivalence. But could you outline the two ideas for us and why, in your opinion, mutual recognition, which is what the city pressed for at the beginning of the talks, really got nowhere?
Yeah. So, absolutely. And people use these concepts in slightly varying ways. So just starting with mutual recognition, I think the concept there would be that the two sides would have their system, and they would, you know, mutually recognize the other. And on that basis, there would be cross-border freedom of services. That's sort of one concept. Very closely linked to equivalence, but not identical, because you could have a mutual recognition where one accepts that the provisions in the respective sides are not equivalent. So equivalence, on the other hand, in its technical sense, certainly as contemplated by, for example, MIFIR and EMIR, and there are various other regulations and directives that talk about this, would be, in its classic form, the European Commission, and I guess the other way would be the same, you know, recognizing that the UK regime is equivalent. I was going to say in outcome, that's an open question, whether it has to be equivalent in detail A, B, substance, or C, outcome, open question. Now, clearly, the two in line with each other to the extent that you only grant mutual recognition where there is equivalence. That's an open question. So that's point one. On your question, why did mutual recognition not get there? Well, I think the technical answer to that, if you speak to the EU side, and to some degree, the UK side as well, was really to do with the great debates about autonomy and the concern that anything that, in quotes, binds, I mean, just let's look at the EU side for a moment. Anything that binds the Commission and the European institutions undermines the single market in technical terms and undermines the treaty. That's the sort of formal legal reason that was given, which was why the UK, I think it was in sort of June, July of the last year, the May government then came up with a sort of revised sort of set of concepts in the Treasury slides that were produced publicly, which was effectively to want a form of recognition, but respecting the autonomy of the two sides. That was where the UK then went to. But I think the reason the original, let's call it hard-baked mutual recognition didn't work was exactly this point on autonomy.
So you feel that what really held things up was issues of principle at high political level rather than details of regulation or anything of that kind?
I think that'd be going too far. I mean, I think you actually, as always in the Brexit discussions, probably have a mix, quite a complicated mix of different factors. There was definitely and remains, there remain questions of principle. So certainly the EU side had this point of principle or a particular position which said it can't be identical. Number one, it can't be identical to access to the single market. And number two, you have to have the Commission and other European institutions having autonomy. It's fair to say, as the UK government's complexion also changed, that concept of autonomy also became important on the UK side. And as we've seen, we won't talk about the present yet, but if you see how things have evolved, that's become quite an important thing. So that point of principle has been there. I think it is also true that underlying it, there's a much more big political point, which is, you know, clearly, if the two sides were to grant mutual recognition or equivalence or whatever you want to call it in isolation for this sector, which is such a key sector, how does that play with the rest of the negotiation? So I think, as always in the Brexit debate, you've actually got three or four layers on the tectonic plates, which are coming together and need to be disentangled.
Yeah. And do you think that, I mean, you differentiated there, I guess, between the two governments, the May government and the Johnson government. Do you think underlying the EU approach is a question of trust? So, for example, when the Treasury published its proposals around regulation after Brexit in June, as you mentioned, the idea seemed to be to, as they call it, to have outcome-based equivalence. So the idea is that you would have the ability to diverge on regulation if you wanted to, but with basically the same outcome. Do you think one of the reasons the EU is reluctant to accept that is because they basically trust this government less than they did the previous government not to unilaterally diverge?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think that's, whether you couch it like that or not, I think the reality is that yes, the current government's been very clear that in certain areas, and there have been a few examples of this already, for example, the settlement disciplines under the CSDR, that they will not necessarily have the same approach. And it's very interesting, and it's just worth playing this back. If one looks back at the political declaration negotiated by the May government, although it does not say that there will be literal equivalence, as you rightly say, it talks about equivalence based on outcomes. I think the understanding at the time was that the UK and the EU would, broadly speaking, have a very, very similar regime. Mm-hmm. Okay, there were some questions that needed to be negotiated around, if it had gone ahead on that basis, around what the future would look like, how you would deal with smoothing the passage of changes, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it was a very different outlook to the current government, where whether it is because the EU is not negotiating from their side or it's because of a point of principle, but whatever one thinks the reason is, it is a different outlook. And I think the Treasury paper in June this year, as you rightly say, was a harbinger of a very different potential approach to regulation.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we were saying, this is a lot of this is history now, and passporting and mutual recognition, that those ships seem to have sailed. And it seems to me the British government is focusing on two negotiating goals now. The first is to secure this equivalence ruling from the EU. And the second is to, and this is a bigger project, I guess, which is to change the EU's equivalence regime, perhaps with other third country partners, to make it more predictable and consultative. It looks as though the equivalence ruling on the EU side will now slip into 2021. Why is that? And will it matter in legal and business terms, in your opinion?
So both very good questions. So on, I think on the first, as you know, the official position of the Commission, as they stated in the papers in June, is, you know, don't expect equivalence anytime soon, essentially, on the key dockets. I mean, whether one takes that as a statement of intent or a shorter-term political, pragmatic statement, I think is an open question. But I think everyone is assuming for the moment that could be their final position. I mean, just put a caveat in that. If there were to be an overall deal on fisheries and other things, who knows, that could open up that discussion. But I don't think anyone would be wise to assume that is inevitably going to happen, which leads to your second question, which is what are the practical implications? I think in the context of the larger institutions, it's important to remember they've all had to work on the basis of no deal planning for the last 4 years. I mean, both the PRA and the FCA have forced them to do that, and the ECB, the European institutions. And so from a technical perspective, it is largely reflective of the plan that they are already on. And so I think in one sense, you could say, well, it shouldn't be too dramatic, because if there is no equivalence at the end of the year, then, you know, that's pretty much what everyone's been assuming anyway in their regulatory planning and commercial planning. What that does leave open is whether it will lead to them, realizing their plans, putting them into action more quickly. I don't know the answer to that. But my sense, and it's always difficult to predict, is that there is a lot of truth in that point. And therefore, the fact that regulators have forced institutions to work on that basis should smooth the process.
Mm. And I mean, as a practicing lawyer, could you envisage there being practical day-to-day problems if there is this period of legal uncertainty between non-grant of equivalence and granting of equivalence?
Well, what is certainly true is it's going to be complicated. But then I think, if you look at the work we've been doing, and I'm sure my colleagues in other firms have been doing, there are almost two or three forms of it. You have the conversation around what would the big equivalence thing look like. That's a small part of the discussion. You then have, I think, the much more important part of the conversation, which is, let us assume now there is not going to be any immediate equivalence. What does that mean for our business? And if you're a bank or an asset manager or a broker, what does that mean for our business? You know, what do we do into the UK? What do we do into Europe, into the EU? And importantly, in which EU jurisdictions? And let's be absolutely precise. And the realities are that most of the medium-sized, larger institutions have done lots of analysis saying, well, okay, you know, we only deal with this kind of client, this kind of jurisdiction. In that jurisdiction, there's a transitional, there isn't a transitional, or we'll rely on, you know, double hatting, reverse solicitation or whatever, or we won't have those clients anymore, or we'll set something up in the EU. So a large number of those discussions have been had. I'm not saying it's perfect, And I'm not saying anyone is anticipating complete certainty. But the interesting thing, and this is a big difference between now and, let's say, a year and a half ago, is there just feels to me like there's a lot less panic about this. Now, that could be because in the meantime, we've had the COVID crisis. And therefore, you know, Brexit's really bad, but then there's something even worse that's come along, which, you know, is a psychological point, but it's true. Or it could be that people just have done an awful lot of the analysis I've just referred to. And so they've sort of ended up with their Swiss cheese analysis and they kind of accept it. And I think it could be a bit of both.
Yeah, I wondered that too. And I had assumed that a lot of it simply was people were very focused on COVID. But I saw this survey by EY in January that looked at the plans for financial institutions to move business into the EU during the second half of 2019. And it showed that that had already slowed down, which does seem to confirm your suggestion that, that people have basically done their planning or done the bulk of their planning already.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we have lots of clients. I'm sure there are many others who've created an entity in the EU. Yeah. There may be questions left, and there are questions left about, you know, how much business you move back to the UK, or you move into the EU, what will be the attitude of the UK authorities, will the UK start to close its borders, and all those sorts of things will be dynamic. I don't think anyone is suggesting that firms are not going to need to keep a very close eye on developments, not just leading up to the end of the year, but beyond. But I think most institutions, not all, have got a degree of planning in place, which means that the panic of 2 years ago or 18 months ago just doesn't feel the same. Now, that could all change, of course. Mm.
Yeah, I'm just moving on to where things may develop from now on. I mean, the question that's always struck me really since the beginning is what it is that people want. What is the whole idea of this is to have the ability to diverge in terms of regulation. And when I look, for example, at MiFID II, the Second Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, which is not exactly loved by traders and certainly not by independent research providers, but it does seem to be quite liked by British regulators. And in their chapter on MiFID, in your book, Nico Leslie and Aaron Taylor say there's unlikely to be sudden legislative change. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of me saying, what do you think it is that people want to change? Because the obvious one, for example, would be to remove the bonus cap that's in the Capital Requirements Directive. But after COVID, and as you said, the banking sector itself has kept its head down for 10 years. Is any government really going to dare to do that? Where would you see the scope and possibility for divergence over the coming years?
I think that's a great question. I mean, first things first, a couple of general points. Number one, I don't think there's any suggestion there's going to be a bonfire of regulation. Yeah. And in fact, you made a very powerful point, which is quite a lot of what is, I mean, just take MiFID as an example, but there are other dockets that are the same. Quite a lot of what's in there is actually UK inspired. Mm. So, you know, for example, the product provider and distributor regime effectively is our old RDR, I mean, with some bells and whistles, you know, things like that. And in fact, you know, the idea that the UK is always more liberal than the other countries, that is not always true. So I agree with that entirely. I don't think there'll be a bonfire of regulation. Two points maybe to make on that. Number one, depending where the EU goes next, and without the UK, the influence of perhaps the more market-oriented jurisdictions perhaps will be less. Mm. There may be some divergence there. So if the EU does go in a more dirigiste sort of direction, which is possible, that could be one area. Now, that's a slightly sort of hypothetical if it could happen, but I think that is a real prospect that the UK may not follow all of the things going forward. And I thought the Treasury paper was interesting in beginning to touch on that. So that's one point. The second is, actually, whether or not in the vast majority of the European regime there's going to be major change, I think there could be a considerable amount of simplification in the UK regime. The FCA and Treasury PRA have begun to talk about that. And could we see some liberalisation of some areas? It is a possibility. But the interesting bit, when you ask people directly in the city, what is it you want to get rid of? Well, there are one or two things people mention. And there's position limits in commodities. There are some aspects of the transparency regime. You know, there are probably, one could come up with a list of things, but it's not, subject to your point on the bonus cap, it's not some, you know, we want to get rid of a whole of a regulation or some dramatic thing. It is more likely to be a gradual process.
And do you think that could be managed? I mean, the reason I ask is I spoke to a European official that was pre-COVID, and he's not specifically involved in this area, but a highly placed official. And he said that the bulk of EU financial services legislation tends to be putting into effect agreements made in Basel and yeah, so on.
Gotcha.
And inevitably, when you put something together with 27 or 28 countries using a particular negotiating method, this can sometimes be implemented inefficiently. And his hope was that a single country implementing these things would actually do it more efficiently and could provide a sort of template for the EU. You know, this is an EU official. Do you think that's the kind of position we could end up in if both sides show some goodwill?
I think you've absolutely hit on the point. Where there's a will, there's a way. You know, objectively, if you actually look at the realities of the financial services discussion from what we've just been talking about, there isn't great proposed divergence. There are some areas potentially. It is completely correct that the UK could well be a very good model, as it is for other countries around the world. I mean, often Singapore and Australia and other jurisdictions look to what the UK does. With goodwill on both sides, there would be definitely an opportunity to have a sensible two-way dialogue, pretty much equivalent sort of standards with some tweaks. The problem at the moment is the goodwill isn't there. And so, unfortunately, financial services is caught up in a much larger discussion which ties into all sorts of fairly unhelpful instincts on both sides that have nothing to do with financial services. And I think that's been the dilemma of our sector throughout this, that actually, if you talk privately to officials, I think on both sides, the general gist has been, well, on financial services, we actually, you know, had a pretty good negotiation and we're probably not that far apart. But unfortunately, we're caught up with a much larger discussion.
Yeah. Well, one final question. And on that score, I mean, do you have plans already to update the book next year once we're on the other side of this?
We have been talking to the publishers about that. I think the dilemma with the book is the same as the original dilemma, which is from the moment you decide to update it to the moment you actually get to publish the update, who knows what's actually going to happen?
Yeah.
And so it is a bit of a dilemma, but it does make sense to update it. And I think the realities are, you know, whichever way things go later this year, it probably would be a really good thing to do because there's going to be demand. I mean, on the assumption that we're not going to have complete certainty. And well, I suppose my final comment on this would be, I think we're not going to have a settled state for a very long time. So the book and things like it are probably going to be in demand, I would have thought.
Yeah. What was the lead time between each chapter? Well, probably the minimum lead time between writing a chapter and it getting published. I mean, how much scope do you have to update?
I think the problem, I mean, this is more a question for OUP, is because it's a physical book as opposed to an internet book, you know, just getting the typeset done and everything takes 3 or 4 months by the time you've kind of done proofing all the rest of it, which, you know, in Brexit land is an eternity.
Yes.
And that's the difficulty. So, I mean, we are actually going to have a discussion around the best way of doing it going forward. But that is one of the problems with a book on this area, that life is so fast moving.
Yeah. Well, to remind our listeners, today, Jonathan Herbst and I have been discussing Brexit and Financial Regulation, published in March by Oxford University Press and perhaps to be republished next year. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Pleasure.